And I want to thank Tammy and the CPHPD section for putting on this session and sort of picking up the baton after we got the position statement adopted by the association last year. And just say that myself and my colleagues are really representing the public health nursing section here. I'm not speaking on behalf of my employer, the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. And tell me how I should press, where I should press. Right here. I'm sort of sorry to say I have no financial support coming from anywhere and no real conflict of interest on this. I do get a flu shot every year. I haven't gotten my flu shot yet this year. I'm telling myself I'll do it before Thanksgiving for sure. I'm old enough to have acquired immunity for most other vaccine-preventable diseases the hard way. That's the so-called natural way. And that makes me old enough as a nurse to remember the period or the decade when one after another pediatric wards in the hospitals of New York City closed as vaccines became available and the numbers of children hospitalized with complications not just went down dramatically but actually disappeared. I have no particular interests in immunization, however, or influenza or related policies. I'm not involved in that work in my day job, as they say, or my night job, or and haven't been in the last two decades. And as I said, I'm not speaking on behalf of my employer, and I should point out that the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene is not the New York State Department of Health, which had issued that regulation, that mandate that was discussed earlier. And the city department of health has no authority over making such regulations or regulating hospitals or nursing homes and so on and so forth. I would also add that I am a strong union member and that several of the authors who contributed to preparing the APHA policy statement are not only strong union members, but officers across a number of different union locals. And the preparation of the policy statement, which was adopted by an 82% vote last year at the APHA Governing Council, was truly a collaborative effort across multiple sections and components of the association. In both the preparation and then subsequently endorsement before it actually went to consideration by the Governing Council. And what got us started was not so much a position on mandates, but in that year, the fall of 2009, when the media was so interested in all things flu after H1N1, and New York State came out with that proposal, and people, health workers who were opposing it, in fact, it was nurses who were often quoted by the media or seen on TV, their reasons for not wanting the mandate were often misinformation. The vaccine's not safe, the vaccine's not proven, the vaccine's not effective. And so we really got mobilized to address the misinformation that people opposing the mandate were using, rather than saying, I just don't want it. It's my right to not get it if I don't want to. I just want to emphasize two things about APHA position statement. It's very clear, the goal is not mandates. And the position statement says very clearly, it's not, mandates would not be a panacea, would not substitute for other good vaccination programs, cannot be a way to avoid education programs, but rather that it can be, one size doesn't fit all, but in some situations it can be a reasonable means to enhance the goal of achieving vaccination rates. And we do take the position that mandates are not inherently bad in and of themselves. It's not a new position for APHA. I'm going backwards, which I do often. Since 1989, APHA has had the policy recommendation for all healthcare workers and laboratory workers to be immunized against all vaccine-preventable diseases that they could be potentially exposed to in their work. And it's sort of interesting how the pendulum has swung. Here we have in the last decade so many other organizations coming out supporting requirements for vaccination. And what really changed in that decade in the 1990s, we had a growing anti-vaccine movement in general, or I should say movements. And at the same time, we had the internet development through the 90s and 2000s. And so we have not only a very strong anti-vaccine, many activist anti-vaccine groups, but a means for them to communicate not only their views, but often misinformation to support their views. And that can be counterproductive, even in counting healthcare workers and healthcare professionals as part of their audience. So the basis for why to have a mandate, or even the whole picture of the APHA position statement. And the point of the position statement was to bring that 20-year-old policy and to provide an overview of the updated information, the state of the art and the state of practice around influenza prevention. So it's not just recommendations around mandates or recommendations around vaccination. And we looked at the science of epidemiology, both the epidemiology of influenza and the epidemiology of vaccine uptake. Vaccinology, the safety and efficacy of the vaccine, and behavioral science around health promotion, behavior change, beliefs and attitudes about vaccines in general, influenza vaccine in particular, and health workers and health promotion, not just around vaccination, but in general, health workers, health-related behaviors. And also behavioral science around mandates, which previous speakers have pointed out can be an important part. We looked at law, we looked at, and in the public health nursing section, when this was brought up, the primary focus was around the issue of social justice. Who gets the vaccine? Who works in healthcare? Who is most vulnerable to the complications of influenza? And when you look at access, and when you look at who health workers are, it's nice to talk about healthcare professionals, physicians, nurses, people with a lot of schooling, which doesn't necessarily make them expert at immunization, especially immunizations with adults, which is a something that's really, adult immunizations have really come up in the last couple of decades. It's usually practicing pediatricians who deal most with immunizations. And so whatever one learned in school, you know, you have that fall off in knowledge, but you're not necessarily managing, interacting with patients or parents and trying to explain the importance of vaccination to them and the vaccination schedule and so forth. Even hospitalists or nurses working in hospitals and pediatrics are not working with parents and families around vaccine issues. But the larger group of health workers often come from marginalized, lower socioeconomic groups, immigrant groups, groups who are known to have more less access to health care, less access and use of primary care, may not be in a position outside of the work environment for having anyone offer them the vaccine, encourage them to get vaccinated, tell them they need to be vaccinated or the importance of influenza vaccine. And there's that whole part of the health worker population, that same population, that's involved in community work, working in schools, working in homeless shelters, working in parish programs, community-based organizations, and working in home care. And we often consider the home care worker the invisible worker in the healthcare setting. I'm not going to go repeat what others have said, but I do want to make a comment about herd immunity. Of course, when we're talking about a herd of humans, it makes more sense to call it community or community protection. It is not about the community protecting the individual, but rather about individuals' responsibility to the community, to protect the community as a whole. And when we talk about often that the idea that influenza vaccine is not so effective, it's only 50, 60, 70% effective, that sort of implies, especially to people who aren't used to working with vaccines, and I was in that group, that other vaccines are much more effective, when in fact, it's not so atypical for vaccines to be around 70% effective. I work in HIV. We're praying for a vaccine and working towards a vaccine to be 50% effective, and that would be considered quite an achievement, not the ultimate goal, but an achievement if we got that kind of efficacy, not effectiveness. To reach herd immunity for measles, for example, you need to have 95% coverage with two doses. And that's not feasible, of course, to have a second dose on an annual basis, which is what you would need for influenza. The other issue is that when you talk about community protection or herd immunity, you're not talking about this whole community, and when you can say, oh, health worker coverage went up a couple of years ago to 70%, or maybe you get 80% or above 60%. That doesn't help me in my hospital or in the unit where I work if there's a cluster of unvaccinated people. Or it doesn't help the patient that comes to my unit if I'm the unit with just a couple of people or one or two people. Others have discussed facts. Do no harm. The corollary of to do no harm, of course, is to do good. And what about autonomy? We say the primary obligation is to patients. But first of all, we have to remember that autonomy does not mean individualism. Individualism is not an ethical principle. It is an American value, particularly American philosophy. It has nothing to do with ethics. And the two points, very anti-public health of individualism, is that the individual has a right to do what they want, and there should be no in limits on the individual by the community. And the other side of that is that the individual doesn't have any obligations to the community in terms of raising all votes together and so on and so forth. The principle of autonomy in healthcare came from early ethics, which is not saying that early philosophy, autonomy is about not self-determination, but the individual's right to choose among goods, not to choose which good they're going to pursue, not to do something counter to the community's good. And that then proceeded into medical ethics, where it was in a one-to-one relationship between physician and patient. And the opposite was autonomy versus paternalism, the idea that it was the patient, not the physician or provider, who would determine what the goals are and how to best achieve them. In bioethics in the 70s, that then was translated into research, and while research is good for the community as a whole, individual has a right to choose whether or not they want to participate in this good. It goes back to autonomy, choose what good you want. But we have to be careful in extrapolating these kinds of ethics to public health, because we're not talking about autonomy. Autonomy doesn't translate. It's not the same concept. In public health, we talk about moral equality, interdependence, solidarity, social justice. And in the last decade or more, we see the evolution of organization ethics and business ethics, and what a organization owes to the community beyond just the bottom line. I'd like to look, somebody brought up logic before in the logic points, and just say the American Nurses Association says this. Immunization is an important part of comprehensive seasonal flu prevention. Getting vaccinated is one small step to protect patients. Nurses have an ethical responsibility to get vaccinated. You follow that logic and you come to, nurses have the right to choose whether or not to get the vaccine. The image that comes to my mind is from a lot of different cartoons, Wile E. Coyote. It seems like if you're following the line of what the first three things go, you go to a place that you really didn't want to get to, and so, but you're still saying that's what you're, it's not logical to me. Similarly, in the last year, ANA has taken the position, I think, feeling a little bit crowded by other organizations that have taken stands in support of vaccines. They come out and said they would support a mandate if suitable exemptions. Well, no mandates. No one has ever suggested that people who have a medical contraindication shouldn't should be vaccinated. Prohibits discriminating against or disciplining nurses who choose not to participate. It's not exactly sure what choose not to participate in. If there's no consequence for not complying with the mandate, or it's not a mandate, and the other three points, which are pretty much part of most mandates. But let's go back to the first point. I would say two to six are a straw man arguments, because they're really not issues involved in the implementation of vaccines. So they're just taking a stand against what already, or proposing something that's already out there in the forum of mandates. The first point, policy from highest level authority, ideally state government. Sort of another Wile E. Coyote, because it's not typical of ANA to say this about other issues. Typically, ANA applauds, encourages, promotes hospitals and others at the most close to the ground level to be out leading government and regulatory groups, standard-setting bodies, not waiting or waiting even for their deadline or effective points. The carrot or stick. We have said that is a false debate, that we need both carrots and sticks, and that mandates are in fact not solely a stick, but are also carrots. A requirement provides the nudge. It counters procrastination. And more important, not requiring or saying you can negotiate to avoid it in certain circumstances, that it sort of suggests that the vaccination isn't important. You have to be clear and consistent in the message. Either it is important or it isn't, and if it is, why aren't you insisting on protecting me? If I'm the worker and I could get ill at work, why aren't you protecting me? And I would say also, why are my union organization fighting for that protection? So we have to remember the goal. The goal is community protection. The community that makes up a health organization, the circumstances, the work environment where people spend more than a third of their time. The goal is achieving adequate vaccination coverage. It's not to enact or promote mandates. The QA principle is, if it's broke, fix it. The question then is not to mandate or not to mandate. I agree with a couple of other speakers who said that, but to determine if we're going about influenza prevention the best way. A basic QA principle is if you keep doing what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. And if you're not satisfied with how well we're doing influenza prevention, how well we're achieving the goal, then we've got to change what we've been doing. There's a lot of evidence, piles, mountains perhaps. This is sort of what my office looks like and has nothing to do with influenza necessarily. the idea is we have to be look for, not keep repeating studies about mandates working, not mandates, but acknowledge the gaps and pursue them. And just like with tobacco control, are we going to wait till we have all the information we need, 100% proof positive that this works or that works, or follow the precautionary principle, which tells us that we can't wait till we're 100% sure that there's a problem. We need to get out ahead and solve it. And so I suggest that we have to be open to looking at all the data, identify the gaps, try to help fill them, but not start with what our conclusion is, and not go off the cliff saying we know what we want the end result to be. Thank you.
Great panel, and I'm hoping that maybe we'll have a little lively discussion here. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
Can I ask a question back?
Yeah.
So how long were you, how many years were you allowed your campaign to go on before you declare it a failure?
Well,
now, and I mean that reversed. How long will you be patient waiting for success?
Well, it's not completely up to me. There's a whole committee of us. I'm the sort of the instigator, but there are doctors and there are the leadership at Kaiser. A whole bunch of people are involved, so they will decide how long. So they've given me a budget. This is the first time we've done this.
Let me give you one of the strongest predictors of getting immunized is previously having been immunized. So every year you can expect that the group that got immunized last year is likely to say, oh yeah, I did that last year, I'm happy to do it again. And you're going after the people who did not the year previously. So you staircase your way up. And one of the things that I think is going to be interesting is to see how quickly people say, or at 40%, you ran this great campaign, look at all that effort, you got up to 60%, it's a failure, we're done, we're going for a mandate. And I think that that is premature given the sociology of how you change a culture. It does not happen overnight.
No, I totally agree. Somebody as a health educator, I know behavior change is difficult.
And so you may want to negotiate that up
front. People are afraid of needles. It's hard to believe that they're giving shots. They're afraid of needles. They think they're going to get the flu from the flu shot, you know, and they understand how viruses and, you know, it's just crazy. But my sense is I want to stay positive, and I'm going to continue to be positive. And I think we're trying to show, make mentors in all the centers and show that there are people who want to get the flu shot for the right reasons and sharing that information. And we're hoping that there's going to be some peer pressure to say, hey, you know, let's do this as a team. Let's do what we know is right to do.
And I would negotiate for a 3-year effort. Because there's herd immunity, but there's also social norms that accumulate over time.
I think
also you'll find that, like you were saying, having mentors or buddy system, whatever you want to call it, is going to help your effort. I mean, a lot of people who are either fearful of immunizations or have maybe heard something, getting personal. Getting personal information from a coworker can be very helpful, much more helpful than perhaps handing out a pamphlet or seeing a poster. Those personal stories are helpful, and I'm a health educator, also in immunization, and we use personal stories and video stories.
How do you define your workforce? How do you define your workforce? Does it include the admin staff, for example?
Yes, it's the entire, it's
everyone,
both the doctors and the administrative staff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to places where we're not seeing patients as well. We have mobile carts, and our employee health nurses are making an effort to go to the places where we have just administrative staff.
Mm-hmm. Volunteers and students?
We are using some students, yeah. But mostly that's for member shots. This is strictly employees.
Okay, so it's employees only. Okay.
Yeah, the employee health nurses are responsible for the health of our employees, mm-hmm. and so they take the lead on giving the shot.
I'm obviously a military member. I'm a captain in the Navy. And in the military, everyone's required to have flu shots, not only healthcare workers, but all services. And you know, my understanding, I didn't make this policy, but my understanding is it's an issue of medical readiness in the sense that if a submarine has a flu outbreak, that submarine may be hampered in its ability to carry out its mission. A hospital is not really comparable to a submarine, but it also has a very essential mission to perform for the country and for the community that it's in. And I'm wondering if there are any studies about the impact or the effect of influenza on the hospital's ability to carry out its mission and deliver the services that it must deliver. And secondly, if that's been used to help persuade healthcare workers of the value of giving a vaccine.
Great analogy, then.
There are studies that have shown that vaccination of healthcare personnel decreases absenteeism in the workforce. So that has been shown. And it has been used in some settings as an argument, again, for the responsibility for vaccination to allow adequate staffing, which is another part of patient protection, even if it's not direct disease transmission. You know, if half the nurses on one of the wards are out, then that's obviously a patient safety issue as well. I think a lot of the mandate conversation doesn't go towards the absenteeism and protection of the worker, mostly because I think when it comes to the mandate and people trying to talk about what is an adequate rationale to set up a mandate and to justify a mandate, they are more comfortable discussing the protection of others than protection of self. So if you choose not to get vaccinated because you know, don't care if you get sick and if you miss work, that's kind of your choice. And we can't really interfere with that personal choice of yours. We, as an employer or as a healthcare organization, feel that it's our responsibility when it comes to, you know, you protecting our patients, either through your absence or through, you know, your risk of spreading disease. But I think that because of the view of your own ability to choose whether you want to get sick for yourself, that part of it doesn't come into the conversation as often. But I think that the point of view of readiness and of staffing issues is a very valid part of understanding the need.
If I can add, the studies have looked at actually the return on investment of flu vaccine programs in terms of actually cutting down absenteeism. That's the way that they started in the 80s and 90s to actually look at that question. To my knowledge, there's no study that actually goes to really the direct analogy that patients suffer because your staffing numbers are lower if you have a low immunization. There's now data that in fact probably is true, but there's nothing that addresses it directly. But it raises another problem, which is the presentism, not absenteeism, that there is a probably greater risk of transmitting illness from a healthcare worker to a patient of not just flu, but any of the other transmittable diseases by me feeling like I ought to show up so that I don't leave my colleagues in the lurch. And I go, I load up on my ibuprofen and I show up at work and I cough, you know, I cover my cough, I wash my hands, and yet I still get the patient sick. So there's a two-edged sword of actually raising the issue of not letting your colleagues down and understaffing. In fact, I think one of the, if we were to take the prevention of nosocomial spread seriously, we have to come up with ways to staff that somebody who does not feel well, who meets any of the case definitions of the flu or any other viral illness, actually will stay home. And that's where these ironies start to creep in. Because if you also get immunized with the flu and wind up coming down with it anyway, but believe that you couldn't possibly have it because I got the flu shot and show up for work.
Right, and that becomes an education issue, you know, as part of your influenza vaccination campaign, because you could still have the flu and you could certainly have RSV or parainfluenza or some other illness. And the other issue I think that comes up a lot around that is because the policies that drive the presenteeism usually do not reside in epidemiology. They don't sit with infection prevention, occupational health, and infectious diseases. They sit with human resources. And so their time off policies, ETO policies, sick day bank policies, and how those are used, you know, are structured from a business perspective and are not necessarily structured the way that we wish they would be to allow more flexibility around staying home when you're sick. So we put specific rules around, you know, return to work and guidance around who needs to stay home. But, you know, if you have a sick child and you know you're going to need these days off to take your kid to the doctor multiple times because they have some chronic illness, you're not going to stay home when you have a cold. You know, you're going to save those days for something else. And if that's your vacation time, same thing. So I think that's a big issue around a lot of these questions.
I wanted to just add that the focus group findings that I've seen in the past, absenteeism or the potential of letting your fellow healthcare workers down by being sick was one of the most motivating influencers for healthcare workers to want to get vaccinated. Rather than even above protecting themselves, their families, and their patients. I saw a hand over there.
People who should be least able to opt out are the physicians. I think it is, I'll temper my what I would normally say, to actually take the hired staff that are under the control of the hospital and single them out and exempt the physician strikes me as a social justice issue. But they're all on medical staff. Your medical staff office can actually solve that problem if they rise to the task of doing it. It is not the hospital HR office, but every physician who operates in your hospital has to be credentialed to do so, and your medical staff is required to actually supervise that process. They may not want to deal with this, but it's their problem to deal with. As to the volunteers and all the other people who wander in and out of the hospital, I have no particular wisdom as to how to do that, but the physicians, you have a clear chain of command under the medical staff affairs office.
We get the volunteers also through our volunteer office, and they have to be vaccinated. And the volunteer office tracks that, and they won't let them sign up for shifts if they haven't, you know, provided proof of vaccination. We provide vaccination for them free of charge for the volunteers as well. The volunteer office tracked that as well. And again, our credentialing office is helping us with physician tracking.
And similarly for students, nursing schools, medical schools, and other professional schools, there's usually a contract with the hospital for them to have their students, and if that requirement is part of the contract, then the school has to do that monitoring and affirm. And in some cases, I also know that in addition to the written confirmation and providing the documentation, sometimes there's an indication that the student's ID.
Usually the schools have to say that they're going to follow all the infection prevention or all the policies of the hospital, and so if it's a policy of the hospital, you know, then the students are covered and you can kind of put it back to the school.
And in fact, the students who rotate may be the easiest group to actually have a chokehold on, because they show up on November 1 to start their one-month rotation. Whoever actually welcomes them at the door and orients them to the hospital should be responsible for actually making sure that it's safe for them to be there.
Well, what our challenge is, anybody that's employed can go through our HR software system, and that's where we have our vaccination declaration document. It's the people that aren't a part of that HR software system, like the physicians or the students, where we have
I would post it on another part of your intranet, hospital intranet web, so other people could get access. I mean, that's a practical problem of distributing the form. But it's the chain of command for each of those group of people, how to make sure the appropriate person has it.
I have a question back to you. Are you receiving many declination forms at all? Or are you aware?
It's really early in the program. Last year we did through our HR software, and then we did SurveyMonkey for all the physicians. Employed by the hospital, but we had a lot of, you know, feedback with the SurveyMonkey. It didn't always work. There were issues with that. So while the HR software piece is working great, it's that other component that we haven't figured out how to do that.
Can I just say something about that kind of declination system, which is nice and convenient, but it makes declining easier than getting the vaccine. And so it's in some ways counterproductive. It's almost encouraging declination. You go through all the effort to have vaccination champions and providing it in different, showing that the CEO got her vaccination, et cetera. And yet you say, but if you don't want it, just click here.
But I have to respectfully disagree. All the data suggests if you put in a declination program, as opposed to not having to say anything, that you actually drive the rates up, because people are in general embarrassed to actually decline unless they have a clear religious mandate that they're not supposed to get vaccinated. So I think even the data...
Sometimes. Not all published declination programs have had much impact at all. There have been some declination programs that really have not had much impact on vaccination rates. And the easier it is to get a declination, the less of an impact that it has.
That's one of the things we're working on, because
and
we have some centers that are just have huge numbers of declination, which is hard to believe, that so many people could be allergic. So we're really working on it. The CDC has their immunization information. They say right on there, if you have a life-threatening allergy, or you have been, you know, have terrible experience with a previous flu shot, you can be, but it has to be life-threatening. And in fact, the current vaccine has been reported, I think it was on the CDC website, has very little A component, which is the big, you know, boogaloo that people are supposed to be allergic to. So if you can eat a piece of cake, one of our allergists said, if you can eat a piece of cake with egg in it, you can get a flu shot.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are data from California's Kaiser Permanente, which is after the California statute that requires hospitals to offer and requires that signed declination. That while, in fact, not everybody complied with the signed declination, the numbers of declination went up, and a great boost, but the number of actual vaccinations did not go up that high. So that
did it go up at all?
It did go up, yes.
So I think what I think we need to sort out is actually a declination form shouldn't be I don't feel like it. It should actually require you to have some harassment.
Exactly.
I got to go back to my doctor.
Exactly.
My doctor has to actually countersign it. So I think there's mooch factors in the whole behavioral economics of basically making the burden of actually fulfilling the declination form's requirements. Like, well, and maybe I'll just roll up my sleeve because this is going to take me 2 days worth of work.
Are you confusing a declination form with a medical contraindication?
Right.
It sounds like we might be doing that a little bit.
No.
Well, the declination form also says if you have a life-threatening, and what they've gone on to say is if you have, if you think you have a life-threatening, then verify it with an allergist or with your primary care doctor.
But there is a difference between like a medical exemption, which nobody would question, and a declination, which is declining.
Right.
Or refusing.
It's
just saying, like, I don't want one.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the peer and the contest and that kind of thing.
Yeah. There's a clear parallel in California where I come from, where we have one of the most lenient personal belief exemptions for childhood vaccinations. And, you know, part of the research that we've been able to do on those is that a lot of them come out of convenience because it's so easy for the parent to check the back of this form and hand it into the school that they may not be against vaccinations, they just didn't get around to it by the school date. So I think that, you know, it is a really important concept to have there be some equanimity between getting vaccinated and having to go through the declination process. And question here.
Ours is more documentation, and it starts off with, yes, I got vaccinated. I got vaccinated here at work. I got vaccinated at CVS. I got vaccinated by my primary care physician. No, I did not get vaccinated. And if you said no, it goes through all of those education talking points that are in our regulation, dispelling all of the myths, and then it gives someone a chance to say, oh, wait a minute, I'm going to go get vaccinated. So there's a little bit of a guilt factor put in and an education component put in.
So if someone says they got vaccinated at CVS,
yes.
You have to prove it or anything?
I don't know.
Mm.
Oh, no, we require
it's
that.
It's not a receipt or something.
Mm-hmm. We are at our time, and I am very happy to let our panelists continue this discussion if they have time. I actually have to catch a flight. So I want to give our panelists a round of applause, and then those of you who want to continue the discussion, feel free to...